Okay. Sorry, we had to start over and do a new recording. We're still on this prologue and the introducing ourselves to teleological arguments. And we've been talking about this day, the B theory and A theory of time. So just before I even open my mouth again and talk about anything else, do y'all have any questions about what I've just said? Yeah, so we're ready to kind of shift gears now. Now, as in all things, there are different kinds of teleological arguments. They come in all shapes and sizes. And so, and you'll notice that I don't have like a whole chapter on this because Volume 3 is a work in progress. And I told all of you that there are... The deductive arguments are difficult because they involve abstract reasoning. And so you have to spend a lot of time thinking through all the objections and that sort of thing. The inductive arguments are difficult for a different reason, and that is that I can read the argument and see the flow of it and understand it. But I know that there might be a book out there that's refuted it because it's appealing to different facts that I'm not aware of. And therefore, the only way to really, truly know if your argument is a strong inductive argument, is if you've read a wide array of literature. And so there's some teleological arguments that I'm totally convinced of, and then there's some that are popular out there that I'm not convinced of. So I'll go ahead and just say this. Now, I'm going to be doing intense study over this for the next couple of weeks and so on, and so maybe I might change my mind. But I'm currently not fully convinced of the intelligent design arguments. And by the intelligent design arguments, I'm talking about the argument from irreducible complexity to the idea that this must have been intelligently designed. Why? Well, I've seen the counter arguments coming from atheists and even other Christians, and they've shown that this argument is inductively weak. Now, I'm not convinced that their critique is good either. So where am I on that argument? I don't know. Now, we're going to study it, and we're going to look at all the arguments for and all the arguments against. But I may, when we finally get to that point, I may look at you and say, I think that we just still need more time on this.
What are the options? Intelligent design, evolution?
Right.
Evolution,
natural selection. I guess you would say chance. But you have to understand that if I'm reading someone and they're giving these responses to the argument and I'm not seeing the responses coming from those who defend the argument, and I myself am not really sure how to overcome the argument, I don't feel comfortable giving the argument as a good piece of evidence. Now,
like some other B theory you're running to.
Right.
Right.
When it comes to like the fine-tuning argument, I am convinced that that is a very strong argument, so we're going to look at that. So I have different teleological arguments that I'm attracted to, and then there are others that I'm not that attracted to, or at least I'm putting on the back burner. I need to read more. There may be answers to some of the concerns that have been raised that I just haven't run into, and that just means that I haven't read enough. And of that, I would totally admit. I mean, I've only read about 10 books or so on the intelligent design stuff.
Fine tuning is different than intelligent design.
Yeah, it's a totally different argument. Now you'll remember when we started this whole process of natural theology that I introduced you to a figure named Thomas. Do you remember him, Lance?
Yes.
Thomas is this guy stuck in a cave. And we showed that even if he's virtually blind, deaf, and dumb, he can still know that God exists simply because of the idea of God. The idea of God proves the reality of God. By the way, Reason to Believe just released my discussion with Ken Samples on the ontological argument. And so you can watch that video now. And we had a fun time doing that. And I said, well, this completes sort of my apologetic for theism that I've shared with my students over the years. So... I was really thankful that they allowed me to do that. And then I also pointed out that, well, what if Thomas began to reflect on some experiences he's having, like this something's taken off of his mouth and he's given food and water every couple of days, and he feels a little bit more nourished, he can start reflecting on the fact that he really is contingent and that he needs a cause. And so even in that circumstance, he could know with certainty that the uncaused cause exists. So he could move from an ontological argument to a cosmological argument. Well, then imagine that Thomas is freed from his chains and he learns to walk, and the people that have freed him start giving him healthier food and then begin teaching him about the flow of time and that sort of thing in the cave, right? He's not out of the cave, but he's there learning. Well, he could maybe learn that time is of limited duration, which would imply that time has a beginning, which implies that God is not merely the sustainer of the universe, as the Thomistic argument suggests, but God is the creator of the universe. Well, what happens if Thomas leaves his cave? And that's what the teleological argument is about. It's about leaving the cave, leaving the study, and going out and exploring the world. And the idea is that the more you explore the world, the more confident you're going to be of God's existence. Even with all the qualifications that I've been giving you, it's a powerful consideration to think that as you go out and explore, you're going to run into facts that really do look like they were meant to be here. Now, you may be wondering, who inspired this figure Thomas? Well, the person who inspired Thomas for me was Aristotle. And I read this quotation of his. I'm actually have his complete works. So this is volume 2 of the Complete Works, edited by Barnes, and this is page 2392. And this is what we call a fragment. We're not 100% sure Aristotle said this. This is Cicero quoting Aristotle. And so we think Aristotle, why would Cicero lie? Well, Cicero probably wasn't lying, but we don't know for sure if the quotation that Cicero is giving really does go back to Aristotle. But we attributed this to Aristotle, and this is Aristotle's quotation. Now you can see how I was inspired to create this Thomas character by this quotation. Aristotle says, "Suppose there were men who had always lived underground in good and well-lighted dwellings, adorned with statues and pictures, and furnished with everything in which those who were thought happy abound. Suppose, however, that they had never gone above ground, but had learned to report, and they had learned by report and hearsay, that there was a divine spirit and power. Suppose that then, at some time, the jaws of the earth were opened, and they were able to escape and make their way from those hidden dwellings into these regions which we inhabit. When they suddenly saw earth and seas and skies, when they learned the grandeur of the clouds and the power of winds, when they saw the sun and realized not only its grandeur and beauty, but also its power, by which it fills the sky and with light and makes the day, when again night darkened the lands, and they saw the whole sky picked out and adorned with stars, and the varying light of the moon as it waxes and wanes, and the rising and settings of all the bodies, and their courses settled and immutable to all eternity, when they saw those things, most certainly they would have judged both that there are gods, and that these great works are the works of the gods." It's an interesting quotation. In other words, just seeing the world around you lets you know that it's intelligently designed. Now, what's the problem with the quotation? Well, Aristotle is suggesting that you have to be a polytheist once you see the design in the world. So what does the teleological argument not prove? Or at least, yeah, it's possible that there are no teleological arguments that prove monotheism. I mean, this is actually David Hume's criticism of the argument. David Hume said, the argument is built on analogy. Okay, so I walk through the woods, as William Paley said, and I see a watch lying in the forest. Well, it's not like a stone that I might find in the forest. If I see a stone, I would say, for all I know, this has been here forever. But if I see a watch, I'm automatically going to think that this watch came about from intelligent design. And Hume said that's because you've had experiences of watches being made in the past. Okay.
What about the tree he sees?
Well, that's the problem. Can you make that same analogy with nature? Are the things
complicated? knowledge.
Right, and so that's what Paley is arguing. He's saying, when I think about the eye is far more complicated than a watch is, especially watches that he was familiar with, right? And so he would say, the eye, if I find things in nature that are analogous to that watch, then I have to conclude that those things in nature are design. And that is an inductive argument. It's an argument by way of analogy. So what is a kind of an abductive argument. You're combining inductive and deductive reasoning here. But what Hume said is, well, your argument from analogy fails because you have, on the one hand, these things in nature, and you don't know where they came from. They're just there. And then you have these experiences of watches, for example, being designed. And he says two things. First, you've made a false inference. You don't know that the analogy works. We don't have another universe to compare this one with. This is all we know. So how do you know that by way of analogy, the tree was designed or the eye was designed and so on? And then second of all, Hume said this, and this is the more important point I want to make. He said that if you want to push the analogy, what are the analogies between great works that have been designed and the great works of nature, like trees or mountains or whatever? Well, the analogy would be that it took many people to build that statue. It took many people to build this great work, this bridge or this boat. It even took several people to maybe even design the watch. And therefore, what does the teleological argument prove? It proves polytheism. And he may even be smiling and say, well, that's what Aristotle said. You know, he might smile at this quote. He may have even been familiar with Aristotle's quotation, because I know that he was familiar with Cicero.
That's skipping a step. It seems like it's going too far for the analogy. The analogy is not trying to say how many people or how many creatures.
Very good.
It's only trying to say design and creating.
Very good. So what many people in the intelligent design movement are saying is they are saying Zeus will do.
And then I've heard them say, and from my own conclusion, I believe this, that it reinforces my personal
right. So
worldview.
The intelligent design movement is a movement that was started in the 1990s, and it was spearheaded by Michael Behe's book, Darwin's Black Box. And the idea is that there are certain features in nature that are irreducibly complex, such that if you take one part of it away, it can no longer function in nature. Okay, we're going to analyze the argument later, but here's my point. There were those who immediately said, you're just more sophisticated creationists. Well, how did they define creationism? For the public, creationism is defined as the belief in, first, a monotheistic God who, second of all, creates the universe in six consecutive 24-hour days. And so the idea is that we want to bring this teaching of six-day creation into schools. And therefore, from the beginning, our science classes are run by those who appeal to the supernatural to explain things. Okay? And because science only deals with natural causes, that has no place in the science classroom, the idea that God created the world. And the ID people, the intelligent design people, are saying, no, we are not saying that it's God who did the designing.
Or six days.
There are atheists and agnostics who are part of the intelligent design movement. There are six-day creationists who are part of the intelligent design movement, and then there are old earth creationists that are part of the intelligent design movement. Paul Nelson is a six-day creationist. Michael Behe is an evolutionist. He believes that God created the first cell, and then from there, natural selection took over, and everything has the same common ancestor. And then there are people like Stephen Meyer, who is not an evolutionist. He believes that there's too much discontinuity between the species. So you have a breadth of perspectives in the ID movement. They're all committed to one simple proposition. And that simple proposition is that there are certain features in our world that have the feature of design, and that design must have come from an intelligent cause. That's all they're saying. They're not saying what that intelligent cause is like, who that intelligent cause is, or whatever. Okay? Now, there are atheists out here who think that they are being intellectually dishonest. I do not believe that they are being intellectually dishonest. I think that they are being intellectually honest. They truly believe that this is a sound, or at least a strong inductive argument for a designer of many of the features in our world.
My car washer heard 5 minutes of it.
Yeah. Now, you raise an interesting point, don't you? Because the teleological argument is historically the most persuasive argument for God's existence for everybody. For the common person on the street, the teleological argument is the one to beat. Most people, they don't want to talk about necessary beings and contingent beings and B theories of time and A theories of time. That's just too abstract for a lot of people. But when you say, hey, look, if you found a watch in a forest, you would automatically say it's design. How much more designed does the eye look? The eye looks extremely, much more complex than a watch. And that makes sense to a lot of people. It just seems so obvious. And therefore, even though Hume, to the satisfaction of many, 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 many intellectuals in the 18th century, even though David Hume destroyed the design argument, and then Kant came along and even killed it more, Kant himself said, this is the one argument that I have the utmost respect for, short of acceptance. So he gave the teleological argument all the praise you possibly could give an argument without actually saying it's a good argument, without actually accepting the argument itself as a strong argument for God's existence. And so even after Hume and Kant had come and gone, William Paley's Natural Theology, which highlights the teleological argument as the argument to contend with, that book, Natural Theology, was a book that you had to read before entering, I believe it was Cambridge University. In other words, before you could even enter into that college and start studying, Natural Theology was required reading. Every good, educated British person had to be familiar with natural theology before he could earn his degree. And it was Paley's Natural Theology,
Paley.
P-A-L-E-Y, William Paley. It was his Natural Theology that Darwin is responding to in The Origin of Species. Darwin is basically saying Paley is wrong. I mean, that's the point of The Origin of Species, is that we can come up with a purely natural explanation for all the apparent design we see in nature. That's the state of the teleological argument now. And so the idea is that even though we've refuted the cosmological argument, this would be the minds of a lot of people. After Hume and Kant, and there was further reflection, a lot of your Germans especially were like, okay, we refuted the cosmological argument. We've refuted the ontological argument. Kant said all versions of the cosmological argument rest upon the invalid ontological argument. And all versions of the teleological argument rest upon the invalid cosmological argument. Therefore, he says that natural theology is a house of cards. Now, we've argued that the ontological argument is a certain kind of argument, and the cosmological argument that Thomas gave, which Kant never interacts with, stands on its own. It's not connected to the ontological argument. In fact, Kant himself rejected the ontological argument. Excuse me. Thomas Aquinas himself rejected the ontological argument. So these are two independent proofs for God's existence. Then we have the Kalam argument.
Philosophical proofs.
Yeah, these are two independent philosophical proofs for God's existence. In fact, all arguments for God's existence are philosophical arguments.
I don't see how that's true, but I don't know.
No, this is good to go into this tangent.
Back, I say, first of all, historically, I think there's an argument. And second of all, I think scientifically there is an
Okay, so all the arguments that you'll hear from me are all philosophical, but some of the arguments, use science in their premises. But the issue of whether God exists is not a scientific question. But science has discovered things which make you ask certain questions. And the only real explanation for the scientific fact that you've given is God exists. But that doesn't mean that the argument is a scientific argument. A scientific argument would be an argument where I go into the lab, I cook up the chemicals or whatever, I make my observations, I do this, and I find a natural cause for it. That's the scientific method.
Progressive.
Yeah. So, therefore any time I say there's a cause of something and it's not natural, a scientist can't go there. But scientists aren't just scientists. They can take off their lab coats and be human and sit and reflect about the implications of what they've discovered. And that's why you do have scientists who have come to the conclusion that God exists.
Can you define the difference between theology and philosophy?
I'll give it to you in terms of first principles. The first principles of philosophy would be those basic epistemological first principles that we've been talking about, like I exist, the laws of logic, the law of causality, and so forth. The first principle of theology for the Christian is the Bible is the Word of God. And so when you're doing theology, you start with the assumption that the Bible is true. When you're doing philosophy, or in this case apologetics, we start at least proximately with the first principles, and we move from there. Okay, so we're not going to get into the ID arguments. I was just using these arguments as illustrations. In our last couple of minutes, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you Thomas Aquinas' version of the teleological argument. And this is taken from another thing I've written, and I'm still working on all of this. So this is the handout I gave you. Lance, do you have the handout?
No. Here it is.
Huh? Yeah, I'll get you the other one in a second. The Thomistic argument. Now, I say another way to avoid either the deistic and or agnostic implications of both modern theistic evolutionists and ID proponents is to explicitly reject a fundamental presupposition of modernism, that efficient causality does not presuppose final causality. So let me back up and tell you what I just said there. The proponents of the ID argument, the ID movement, have been ridiculed as being intellectually dishonest because they're saying, well, we're not saying that the designer is God, okay? And the other argument is that whatever cause you give me is just as good as another one. So the intelligent designer, what is this intelligent designer? Is it the God of deism? Or is it Zeus? Or is it evolution after the first cell comes into existence? The ID proponents obviously wouldn't say that. They would say the first cell was created by this designer. But then there are ID proponents who were theistic evolutionists after that. See? Behe would be an example. So how is there a way to sort of just get around all this and provide a deductive version of the teleological argument? That's the question. Now, it turns out that the difference between the modernist and a person coming out of the Middle Ages was that among the first principles that the medieval scholastic was working with was the principle of finality. Now, you'll remember when we went back, and this takes us back to our very first forays into apologetics. Remember back in Weltanschauung, chapter 1, I gave you first principles, and then we repeated those in chapter 1 of natural theology. I gave a list of first principles, and those first principles were something exists, the law of non-contradiction, the law of excluded middle, the law of identity, the law of causality, and then the law of credulity, or the principle of credulity. Principle of credulity meaning I just accept what my senses give me until I'm convinced otherwise, right?
Those are reasons
These are first principles that all people must start with when they want to know anything. And these are self-evident first principles. I listed them towards the end of chapter 1. But I gave that list, and that list of first principles excluded the principle of finality. Now, what is the principle of finality? Well, the principle of finality is the idea that all things act towards an end. Now, why would I exclude finality? And I did this on purpose. Why would I exclude finality in my list of first principles?
Time.
You're saying that all things move towards an end.
Time moves towards an end.
Yeah, if that's a first principle, then time would be something that moves towards an end. What's the problem with having that as a first principle? There's an advantage and there's a problem. And that's why I didn't put it as a first principle, because I understood what kind of debate would erupt. What is an atheist going to say to that?
That there's no end.
He's going to say, how do you know that all things act towards an end? And say, well, that's just a first principle. Well, see, the atheist would say, I know why the law of contradiction is a first principle. At least if he's an intelligent atheist, he'll say that. But I don't understand why the principle of finality is a first principle. I mean, how do you know that all things act towards an end? You're begging the question. And what's the problem with accepting it? Can an atheist accept that as a principle and still remain an atheist? Exactly. If you're an atheist, it is not the case that all things act towards an end. You can't just assume that. The atheist is actually positively rejecting that. So you can't have that as
reality in terms of there's a final end to like your life, when you're done.
Oh no, I'm talking about all things move for a purpose. Okay. All things have an end to them. All things move for a final cause.
I got it.
So remember, I gave you the kinds of causes that exist. I did this in chapter 4. The kinds of causes that exist would be efficient, formal, material, instrumental, exemplary, and final. And and remember, I gave you the example of making the rocking chair. The carpenter wants to make a chair. Well, the carpenter himself is going to be the efficient cause of the rocking chair's existence. The idea in his mind of what the rocking chair is going to look like, that is the exemplary cause of the chair's existence. The tools that he used to make the chair, that's the instrumental cause or causes of the chair's existence. And the materials that the chair is made out of, that's the material cause. The form that the chair takes, in this case it's a rocking chair, is the formal cause. And then the final cause is the purpose for which the chair exists. In this case, he wants a place to sit down. Right? Y'all see the difference between these kinds of causes? Well, the modern thinker says nature clearly has efficient causes, but nature does not have final causes. And so what they did is, they removed Aristotle from the equation. Aristotle was the one that argued for teleology. He believed that teleology was embedded in the movement of all things in this world. And this is why he argued that God is the final cause of the universe, even though he is not the efficient cause of the universe. Right? So that's what the modernist is saying. The modernist is saying all that exists are efficient causes. Nothing that exists is what we would call a final cause. And so I go on to say this. For the Darwinist, just as it was for Epicurus, efficient causes explain everything in nature. Two rocks collide together, and one moves the other in a certain direction. That is efficient causality. Rock A is the efficient cause of the movement of rock B. Neither rock acts for an end. They did not act with a purpose or final cause in mind. That is, they are not like the carpenter who makes a chair for the purpose of having a place to sit. They just acted, and a result followed. That is efficient causality, sans final causality. That is efficient causality without final causality. Now, the Thomist is going to disagree with the modern thinker. Now, I am a Thomist. The difference between someone like me and Ed Fazer is not so much that I disagree that finality exists, but I think that we have to actually argue for finality, for final causes. Does that make sense? The Thomists insist that efficient causality presupposes final causality. Okay? And here are some reasons that he's going to give for that. Several considerations vindicate the presupposition. For example, our Thomistic cosmological argument began with no consideration of final causes, but instead concerned itself with efficient causes only, and yet it ended with a personal and intelligent being who is actus purus, and precisely because he is intelligent, is obviously sustaining the cosmos with some view and end, with some end in view. So that's one vindication of the idea that you can't really consistently believe in efficient causality without also believing in final causality. Hence, as per the cosmological proof, final causation is the ontological ground for efficient causation. Also, our argument from fine-tuning can serve as an excellent internal critique of the modernist assumption. Now, we're going to cover that in the next couple of weeks. But the argument rules out physical necessity and chance as highly implausible substitutes. But let's get rid of that because we haven't covered it, so just get that out of your mind. Finally, common sense should tell us that the atheistic thesis is wrong. For materialists, from Epicurus to Darwin to Dawkins, will have us believe that a bird does not have wings for the purpose of flying, but it flies because it has wings. Now, if you're like me, I find that to be strange. That there was no purpose in the development of the wings of a bird. Does that make sense? I mean, does the point I'm making make sense?
Oh, right. I bet you meant, does it make sense that
right.
a bird flies because it has wings?
The mother does not have milk for the purpose of nursing her baby, but she nurtures her baby or she nurses her baby because she has milk. But does that not strike the reader as backwards? Should we not say that the milk itself exists for nourishing the newborn baby and that wings exist for flying? The eye is foreseeing. It is not an accidental adaptation that a species just happens to take advantage of. Legs are for movement, fingers are for touching, hands are for grasping, ears for hearing, the heart is for pumping blood, and so forth. Now, if you agree with me, and this is an intuition, right? This is what I would consider an intuitively obvious notion, that final causality just endures, it just exists in all the things that we encounter. And that's the common sense interpretation of the things that we see and we encounter. Then it seems like you can provide a deductive proof for God's existence that is teleological in character. Now, if you don't agree with me, if you don't think that final causality just exists in all the things that we encounter, that final causality is just a fundamental part of our universe, or to put it another way, efficient causality presupposes final causality, then this argument's not going to be that strong for you. But here's the argument. A means cannot be directed to an end except by an intelligent cause. In nature, even among non-intelligent things, means are directed to certain ends. Therefore, nature is the result of an intelligent cause. The cause of nature is supernatural by definition and thus transcendent. An intelligent cause is by definition a personal cause. Therefore, a transcendent and personal cause of nature exists. Now let's look at each premise very quickly. A means cannot be directed to an end except by an intelligent cause. In other words, if you have something and it exists for some end, like wings exist for flying, that means that some intelligence had to make the wings for the purpose of flying. And that intelligence either did it through other means, like natural selection, So this is not ruling out the theory of evolution. Or it just created the wings de novo without evolution, any evolutionary process. So I'm not settling the debate between the creationists and the evolutionists here. I'm simply saying that if the wings exist for a specific end, namely to fly, that an intelligent cause had to guide the process to the point where wings existed for the purpose of flying. So notice I'm doing an end run around the whole creation evolution debate. I'm simply giving you an argument for an intelligent designer that just doesn't worry about whether evolution is true or not. That makes sense? In nature, even among non-intelligent things, means are directed to certain ends. Wings are not intelligent, but they have a purpose. They are directed to a certain end. And that means that nature is the result of an intelligent cause. The point is that all things we encounter have some purpose behind them. And therefore, nature as a whole is the result of an intelligent cause. That is the most, that will be considered by many to be committing the fallacy of composition. Because just because I come in across a lot of things that have finality in them, that doesn't mean that everything's going to. And this is kind of the flaw in the argument. You have to agree with me that final causality presupposes efficient causality for this argument to work.
What would be an example that someone would throw out there?
Time.
Time has no purpose.
Well, how do you? The point is that you have to prove that time has a purpose.
Is there another example, or is that the main one?
Well, I just was using it as Lance threw it out, but take a rock for example. I'll save my little anecdote for later, but take a rock. What is the final end for a rock? What's its purpose? Now, it seems to me that any answer you give me is going to be something you can't prove.
Well, I think the University of Georgia Agriculture School can tell you what happens when the composition of the rock breaks down.
Right, but that doesn't mean that the rock exists for a specific end. It just means that rocks exist and there are efficient causes that break them down and it's just matter in motion. Now, if you agree with me, though, that efficient causality, which does exist, even the atheist has to admit that, but if it can't be made sense of except by final causality, and the Thomistic argument would suggest that, then this argument works. Does that make sense? So what am I presupposing when I give this teleological argument? I'm presupposing the soundness of the Thomistic cosmological argument. If the Thomistic argument falls, this argument falls.
Do you have to prove that everything has a purpose or just that many things have a purpose?
The only way to get to a transcendent and personal cause is to say that all of nature has to be the result of an intelligent cause. So even giving me specific examples of nature like the wings of a bird or the milk for a mother, those are non-intelligent things that act for an end. But just because I can come up with those examples doesn't mean that everything in nature acts for an end.
And so why do you have to prove that everything?
Well, if I'm wanting to demonstrate that the cause is transcendent and personal, I have to say that everything in nature acts for an end. Otherwise, I'm stuck with Zeus and one of the gods of the pantheon. In other words, you could have a personal cause who makes something in nature, but that doesn't mean your cause transcends nature. Right? So I showing that something is intelligent in design is not the same thing as showing that the designer is God.
And so time is a dimension with an intended purpose to give human beings a dimension to exist in.
Yeah, but we don't know, unless you think that final causality presupposes efficient causality, you don't know that. Time is just something that exists and we just happen to be here.
So
by pure
having a purpose is insufficient.
Yeah, just... Yeah, the atheist might look at you and say, oh, that's a very reasonable idea. Now show me that it's true. The point is that it's not, the atheist is not, when the atheist or anybody else for that matter, when they critique an argument like this, they're not necessarily arguing against the conclusion. They're showing that you don't have a good way to the conclusion.
Well, we use the analogy to reverse from the chair. The chair came from the material, the chair came from the tools.
Right. And they're saying that final causality exists in the human mind. We act towards ends. Now show me that it exists in nature. And now show me that all things in nature have final causality to it. And I said, as I said, the only way to prove that all of nature acts for an end is to show that efficient causality presupposes final causality. You can't deny efficient causality. So the question is, does efficient causality presuppose final causality? Is final causality a grounding of that? And the Thomistic argument actually goes a long way in showing that you can't really believe in efficient causes unless you believe in a final cause. And so I think C is proven, but I'm showing you why it's proven. It's proven only because the Thomistic argument is sound. The cause of nature is supernatural by definition. Why is it supernatural by definition? Because it's the cause of nature. And therefore, it is above and beyond nature. That should be obvious.
Transcendent means above and beyond nature.
Yeah, transcendent means that it's distinct from nature. And therefore, if you have a cause of nature, you have a cause that is distinct from nature. All right, and then an intelligent cause is by definition a personal cause. And that means that this argument proves that a transcendent and personal cause or a personal cause of nature exists.
I believe it.
So this is a very strong argument if you agree with that grand presupposition. We'll go ahead and stop here and we'll pick it up in 2 weeks.